Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. This evening, we have a guest, Esther Park. She's the CEO of Seneca Capital. Just a moment, Esther will be back and tell you all about what she is up to. It's some pretty exciting stuff, very near and dear to my heart. Remember that you can find us on Facebook. You can also email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. So, thanks for listening. In just a moment, we will be back with Esther. Good evening. Thank you for listening to Heartstock Radio. This is Carol Murphy, your host, and this evening our guest is Esther Park. Hi, Esther.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being our guest. Where are you talking to us from? Are you in Oakland?
Oh, I'm Bay in area? Berkeley.
Berkeley.
I'm in Berkeley. Mm-hmm.
Yay. What's the weather like there in Berkeley?
Oh, it's nice and toasty.
Is it hot, hot? We were having a really nice day.
Yeah, it's not super hot, but it's been a little bit warm. It's been in the upper 70s, lower 80s.
Oh, yeah, that's sweet. So for our listeners, please give a little introduction of yourself and what is Seneca Capital?
Sure. So I often refer to myself as an accidental banker. So I'm in the financial services industry, but I haven't been what you might call classically trained. I didn't go to business school. I actually came to this work through more of a social justice lens. So I actually did my undergraduate work here at Cal, and I started out as a social welfare major. And so I was determined to go into social work and, you know, help poor communities and poor individuals. And then I went overseas for a couple of years and really started to think about what the drivers of economic development were.
Where did you go overseas?
I lived in the western part of Uzbekistan in the former Soviet Union. Yeah. So it was right after the breakup of the Soviet Union. So there was a lot of work being done around economic development because these were people who were transitioning from a communist economy to a capitalist economy. So there's a lot of transition in that. And I found that there was actually really little work going on small business development, which I thought was pretty odd, given that at least in the US, 70% of our GDP is driven by small businesses. So I came back to the US with a sort of renewed determination to really look more closely at economic development and how businesses can play a role in that development. So I ended up working for a community development bank that had a couple of different roles. So one is the actual banking activity. It was on the south side of Chicago. The bank was called Shore Bank. And they were really determined to do business and show that business can be done profitably in low-income areas. And so I was working on some domestic stuff around small business finance, affordable housing, things like that. And then on the international side, I was also doing some work training small business bankers on cash flow-based lending. So that's sort of how I came into finance. I dropped in there in a pretty junior role, and the folks there were great. They said, "We like you, but you got to pick up the finance." So I just sort of picked it up along the way by being in the context of a bank. And so over time, I one day woke up and said, you know what? I'm actually a finance person. I think I can leverage this for other things. And then I was ready to come back to California. And so I came back doing work with social enterprises. So businesses that had a social mission, doing some financing for those types of businesses. And then eventually came around to the world of organic food and beverage, fair trade, and then just continuing to peel back the onion, finally getting into ag. So that's where I am now. And Cienega Capital has an explicit focus on soil health, regenerating the soil, the agricultural soils of North America. And so we're very farmer focused as a result of our work. So all of our investments have to show a very clear benefit to smallholder farmers.
So there's so many questions that I have about what you were just sharing. And one of them was, where do you get your money, essentially? And I know that might be a very personal question, but is it like a venture fund? You consider yourself a venture capitalist?
Kind of. I would say it's more like a family office. So we have one investor, and it's not a secret. Her name is Sally Calhoun. And she really has a passion around regenerative ag and soil health. And so she is a former Silicon Valley entrepreneur and made their money during the tech boom. And so associated with us are several other entities. One is the Piscinas Ranch, which is in San Benito County here in California. And that's a working livestock and cropping ranch. And then there's also the Globetrotter Foundation, which is our sister philanthropic organization. And then we also have a nonprofit education center called the Piscinas Ranch Learning Center. So all of these things working together are really meant to advance the field of soil health in our various ways. And so for me, as the capital side, we're putting capital out in the form of both loans and equity. So I would say we're not like venture capital in the sense that we also do loans, but we do a big variety of and mix of kinds of investment.
For those who aren't familiar, can you describe exactly what you mean by regenerative agriculture?
Sure. So regenerative agriculture is a way of growing either sort of crop type of foods, so vegetables, grains, those kinds of things, fruits and nuts, as well as livestock. So animal husbandry fits into that as well. And these are farming methods that are meant to increase the health of the soil. And when I say the health of the soil, what I mean is that it increases the microbial life and activity in the soil, and it increases the carbon stock in the soil as well. So really good soil has the ability to retain water. It has the ability to, through the growing plants, take carbon dioxide out of the air and put it into the earth. And so you can measure these things on a number of factors, but regenerative ag generally has five principles. And I don't know if you want me to go into them here. They're a little bit technical, but they're all sort of principles that should be observed in order to increase the health of the soil.
Well, I think this is really important. I just recently watched a documentary, Biggest Little Farm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And being an ag major myself, I was so impressed. And I would love it if you could go into that just a little bit more, because our current systems really do not function or work this way at all.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So one of the principles is minimize disturbance. So one of the common pictures that we have of farming is a big tractor going across the field and tilling it up. And, you know, you see the sort of trail of dust. And one of the symbols on the USDA seal is actually a plow. I mean, plowing has been part of our agricultural history for, you know, millennia. And yet that is something that is actually not great for the soil. So when you have carbon in the soil, when you disturb it, the carbon gets oxidized. And when you oxidize carbon, you get carbon dioxide. So you're actually releasing that carbon into the atmosphere. So regenerative ag tries to minimize that disturbance on the soil. So whether it's just minimum or very shallow tillage, or there are some who are practicing no-till completely, that's one of the principles. The second one is to keep living roots in the ground for as much of the year as possible. So when you're driving past a farm or past many farms and you see lots of bare ground, that's actually not good for the soil. We want that soil to be covered because it's the relationship of the plants to the soil that keeps that soil healthy. So for as much of the year as possible, trying to make sure there's always something growing out of the ground. The third principle is to keep it covered for as much of the year as possible as well. So part of that is, you know, if you have green growing plants, that's great. Obviously here in California, we have really severe dry seasons during the summer, and that's not always possible. But if you leave the litter, what we call the litter, so the dry matter, just leaving that to cover the ground is really important because that helps protect the microbial life in the soil. And then a fourth principle is diversity. And so again, you drive by lots of farms and, you know, I just came back from Kansas today and you see rows and rows of corn or rows and rows of soybean and you have acres of just one crop. And that's actually not great for the soil either because you're only feeding one type of microbes, right? And so we want a good diversity of microbes in there. And the way to do that is to grow a good diversity of crops out of the ground. So we want to see as much diversity as possible. And there are some scientists we know who are saying that 7 to 8 varieties is kind of your optimal or minimal number of varieties that you want to have. And then the last principle is to incorporate livestock. So, you know, animals have always been a really important part of our ecosystem. And so we need to make sure that we're continually thinking about how we incorporate animals into the land.
So we're just about at that halfway point, so we're going to take a quick little break, enjoy the music, and we will be right back. This is Heartstock Radio. I'm Carol Murphy, your host. And thank you so much for listening. We have a great guest today, Esther Parks, and she's with Seneca Capital. Hi again, Esther.
Hello.
Can you talk a little bit about what kind of enterprises you invest in and what are your principles and your goals that you're trying to achieve, Seneca?
Yeah. So we're really trying to move money in the direction of a better agricultural system along the regenerative lines that I talked about earlier. And so we do value the work that's actually going on the ground. So we do a lot of investment in farmers directly, which most people don't do. Even a lot of banks won't do that. And so most investments in farmers tend to look like loans because those are the most appropriate kinds of investment for a farmer. And so we will make loans for a variety of things, from irrigation pipe to sheep fencing, even up to land purchases. So it just really depends on what the need is. And we try to meet that need with the type of capital that we can provide. So because we can do everything from debt to equity and everything in between, we can be super flexible and creative with the financing that we bring. And I often describe our approach as the cobbler versus Cinderella approach. So, you know, if you go to a bank, they can do loans and that's all they can do. That's what they're set up to do. And so you go to a venture capital firm and they only do equity because that's what they're set up to do. But to me, that's sort of like the Cinderella approach where I just have a glass slipper. It's a set thing. And I'm looking around for my princess and trying to find out who's going to be the one that's going to fit their foot into this glass slipper and, you know, help me live happily ever after. But we see our role as being more like the cobbler where, hey, if you need a shoe, come on down. We'll talk to you about what kind of shoe do you need? You know, how long do you need it to last? What do you need it for? And then we'll custom make the shoe for you. And so that's kind of how we approach the financing, right? So it's not like if you don't fit into our box, you got to go away. It's if we think you're doing something great, we're going to find a way to help you. And we have the flexibility to provide different forms of financing to do that.
And you mentioned that banks often don't get behind these kinds of operations. And, you know, to me, it just seems like a no-brainer because you're maximizing your inputs, using less, hopefully less water, less fertilizer, less chemicals. Why is it that banks aren't onto this?
Well, a lot of banks don't do farm lending in the first place because it's so subject to what we call acts of God, right? So there are so many risks associated with farming that cannot be controlled. I mean, there are a lot of risks that cannot be controlled, but, you know, bad weather, drought, blight, pests, you know, fires in some cases. So it just, there's so many variables in that sort of unknowable risk bucket, which is why a lot of banks don't tend to want to work with farmers in the first place. Secondly, farm financing is really tied to our crop insurance system. And crop insurance is the primary way in which subsidies are given from the federal government to farms. And the way that the crop insurance system is set up is to reward the very sort of conventional practices. In fact, we know farmers that have been penalized and have lost their crop insurance because they have instituted regenerative practices, which went against some of the rules of crop insurance. And so if you lose your crop insurance, you could potentially lose your financing as well. And so because financing and crop insurance are so tied together, oftentimes the only farms that are getting financed are the ones that are doing the old industrial ag system that our crop insurance system currently rewards.
In one of the interviews that I listened to that you had done previously, you talked about local investment partners. Tell us a little bit about who else you're working with other than, you mentioned a few already, you know, the person that you're investing in, and who else is out there?
Well, investment partners, sometimes when we invest outside of California, you know, we can understand California pretty well because we live here. We have a working ranch that's here. So we know a lot of the variables that go into farming here. But say, you know, I want to make an investment in somewhere in Boston or somewhere in Kentucky or Kansas, I don't know that environment as well. And so when I make an investment there, I would really prefer to try to find somebody to come alongside that's local. And that can be really difficult to find a local investment partner because the work we do is so unusual that there's not a big circle of people out there that sort of would fit into the mold of what we're doing. And so, you know, sometimes it's just individuals, and I often tap into the Slow Money Network. So Slow Money is a national network with chapters all over the United States where people come together to finance businesses in the food and ag sector. So sometimes I'll find good folks there. And sometimes, you know, it might have to be a nonprofit, a community development financial institution. So those are private lenders that have a mission towards community development and small business financing. So it really just depends on where we are. But if we're out of state, we really like to have somebody who's got boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And just what are the rates of return that you're shooting for? So many times we hear that we can't have sustainability and acceptable levels of profits, mm-hmm. and it's either or. Can you touch on that a little bit? What are you experiencing?
So we don't have any return targets, which is unusual for a financial institution. So I am not going after a certain rate of return. And part of this is because of this issue that you mentioned around profits versus sustainability. And I think that as a society and in the financial services industry, we focus way too much on the financial aspect, right? So when we talk about risk and return, we're talking about financial risk and financial return. But what about human capital? What about ecological capital? What is the return on that? And what is the risk of not investing in that, right? So financial returns have skyrocketed and the financialization of our economy has really just hockey sticked. But at the same time, what we've seen is that that's been at the expense of our ecological and human capital, right? So people have been suffering from stagnant wages at the lower end of the spectrum for many years, and we've been, you know, degrading the environment and exploiting its resources, and that's been giving us great returns. But that's not what we're after, right? We don't want the financial returns if we're going to have to sacrifice those other things. So when we look at return, what I want to look at is overall societal return. What does that look like? So, you know, I'm hoping for not a negative rate of return. If we get our money back, we're very happy to put that right back out. So for us, that's like a cycling of that money back into the economy. But at the same time, we need to make sure that our ecological and human capital is being taken care of as well.
Yes. And, you know, timeline is, I think, really important to take into consideration, because in the documentary, the golden year was year number 7, when everything mm-hmm. started to hum and function together as in unison. So mm-hmm. is that kind of your approach here also? You have longer timelines and greater returns over the long haul kind of thing.
Right. So we do consider ourselves a longer term investor. We can be quite patient. Although for us, because often we're providing financing in a situation where others cannot or will not, what we prefer to do is to invest on a shorter term and get folks to the point where they can take on traditional financing. And then when that capital is returned to us, then we can put that out into another project. So we don't like it to be locked up for too long, because then we can't cycle it. But at the same time, we're willing to be quite patient if we need to.
And do you have any advice for those out there listening going, wow, you're my best friend?
Just on the investor side, we really try to encourage other investors to do similar kinds of investing as we are. And I think really there needs to be a gut check around how much is enough. Why do I need to make X rate of return? Right. And I think that for those of us who are probably in the, I don't know how it breaks out, but let's say the 10%, you know, why is it necessary to hold on to so much money and continue to make even more money on top of that? Why aren't we just reinvesting that? And so I think there's a fundamental sort of mental switch that needs to happen to think about investing differently, because we're investing for the future that we want. And so if that's your goal, then you might think differently about what financial return you're looking at. You know, and granted, it's not the easiest thing to do it for the first time. But, you know, just do it at least one time to start out with, and then, you know, see how it goes. And, you know, we encourage people to kind of just start out doing it with a smaller amount of money that they might feel comfortable with. And then, you know, over time, you can get more comfortable with it. So we're encouraging people to just be brave, get out there and try something.
Well, it does seem to be kind of a hybrid philanthropic mixed with investment. So I mean, that was something that's come up in several conversations, is this idea of tapping into philanthropic money and using it more like investment money.
Yeah, I mean, we do have the philanthropy, and, you know, we always say that the philanthropy and the and Cienega Capital, that they live separately because of IRS. So they're separate because of IRS purposes, but really in our minds, we think of it as one fluid bucket of energy. And so, as I was saying earlier about the cobbler approach, right, when we see folks out there who are really doing good work in regenerative ag, we support them with the right type of capital. So, for instance, we were talking earlier about Chico State and their Center for Regenerative Ag. And, you know, that's a fully educational nonprofit kind of activity. So we support them with grant funding. Whereas, you know, a small business is more, a farm is more appropriate for loan. And, you know, sometimes it's generous terms and sometimes it's pretty standard terms. And then other enterprises that have the ability to grow, that equity capital might be the best type of capital for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just sort of, the philanthropy bleeds very easily into the investing. And so in a way, we don't consider them separate.
So if there are founders out there who are looking for funds, how might they reach you? We've come to the end of our show here, and we just want to make sure that folks know how to get a hold of you.
Sure. People can find out more about us at www.noregretsinitiative.com. And there they can find everything about us, including the ranch and the philanthropy, as well as Cienega Capital. And that's the best way to find out how to get to us.
Thank you so much for being our guest, Esther.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Carol.
Love what you're doing. This is awesome. This is Heartstock. I'm Carol Murphy, your host, and we will see you next week. Peace.
And on the sign it said, no trespass.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5, Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at ButteAmericaRadio.org.
That time was near.